This is Mae Bressel. This is side two of tape 389, May the 18th, 1979. December the 4th, 1978, the Jonestown issue of Newsweek has a cover with bodies on the ground, and Time and Newsweek went in with the photographic teams before the bodies were identified or marked, and you see a party line face down with green slacks, and there's a marker on her ankle, on the right ankle. You also find arm markers on the bodies in the middle and a leg marker on another person face down. You see these tags on these people, and on page 41, you see a woman near the poison vat. Her left leg has a marker on it, and another woman's left arm has a marker on it. And on page 43, face down, you see the party on the left has a leg marker on him, and the fourth person over there, the woman, has an arm marker, and then there are other people there. At the far right, there's another arm marker, and up in the corner, a pink blanket is over somebody, and their arm is marked. Now, these weren't for identification of the Army or anybody. These were tags that were put on, and I got a letter from somebody, a prisoner in San Luis Obispo, who mentioned that he wore these kinds of markers when he had tests at Vacaville for various chemicals. And if you go to Time magazine, the same issue, same date, December the 4th, 1978, what's their cover picture of the leg marker is, next to the vat, has, you see this tag around her left leg, and the one on the arm, the left arm, has been removed from Time magazine, but is in another picture that where it isn't removed photographically. And page 18 in Time is similar to page 43. And on page 19, you see a large assortment of bodies in what was the dining hall, the meeting hall, and these bodies have markers on them. If you look very closely, and you may never have done that, you see those markers. And I think we should write to various members of Congress and have them explain what those are. And also then there's a photograph of the passports with a mark, a comment in these magazines, "No exit." And that's because the passports didn't match the bodies. The House committee investigating this matter right now said that guns were moved out of Jonestown after 15 persons approached Lee O'Ryan and asked to leave. The report states that Jim Jones was granted was a self-created Frankenstein. They call him a self-created Frankenstein. After 6 months investigation, they always need that loner, always. Lee Harvey Oswald, the loner, even though he had money and companions in New Orleans, Mexico, Fort Worth, and Dallas. Sirhan, the loner, even though he's in the company of a woman and two other men. Artie Bremer, the loner, even though he was traveling around extensively in rooms with other people. James Earl Ray, the loner, with contacts, cars, and money. So they call, the House committee again calls Jim Jones a self-created Frankenstein. How far does the cover-up always have to go that they're self-created? It's like Dan White in San Francisco. He goes to Ireland once. He goes to Ireland twice. He gets the collusion of the San Francisco Police Department. He goes in and shoots the mayor two shots and then two close to the head without a silencer, walks out of the mayor's office, past another supervisor, Diane Feinstein, goes into Harvey Milk's office where he shoots four or five bullets, walks out. He's seen leaving there. No one else is there. He asks for the keys to a car, Miss Abkar's car, the secretary, used to be his secretary. She knows her car is gone. She knows her license number. They know that two men are dead. Diane Feinstein has called Chief of Police Gaines and said, Harvey Milk is dead. They don't put out a police bulletin. He has time to go to the doggy restaurant at Van Ness, to call his wife, to go to a church, to walk to a police station, and the policeman and the security didn't put out sirens or whistles to pull in Dan White. How far do these cover-ups go where they're totally protected by the environment around them? Now, they call Jim Jones a self-created Frankenstein. He's not self-created. He was supported by the CIA, the FBI, the Los Angeles Police Department, Attorney General Evel Younger, the U.S. Attorney William Hunter, San Francisco District Attorney Freitas, Stanford Research, Prime Minister Burnham in Guyana. The Guyana police saw Congressman Lee O'Ryan shot at an airport, and when they came up and asked for help because six were dead and others were wounded, the police got in a car and drove away. If Jones were an individual Frankenstein that went crazy, they would have rushed right in to help the wounded. There is every bit of evidence of contingency plans to kill Ryan if anybody left. I knew it 6 months ago, and they're talking about it now. Now, Mr. Dan White, the Great White Knight, is part of that zombie hit team. As I say, he's programmed like Sirhan Sirhan. There was another article this week about Sirhan being a programmed killer. The San Francisco Chronicle, the National Enquirer, killed stories about Jonestown. Why did they kill them if Jim Jones was just a self-created monster or Donald DeFries was a self-created revolutionary? Why did the most expensive press, the Hearst Empire, suppress all of this and allow it to happen, even suppress the information on the kidnapping of Patty? If he was a self-created Frankenstein, how did he get tax exemption as a church when it wasn't a church? How did the State Department turn down all appeals for help when they now say they goofed and all these babies and 1/4 of the population was under 16 years of age? Why did the Guyana government become part of the conspiracy? If he was a self-appointed Frankenstein, I can't believe for the sake of the sex of a few temple members, all the Guyanese government kept quiet, or why they allowed the prime minister to go in and take away jewels and papers before the bodies were removed, and goodness knows what else he cleared out. Now, these hit squads of Jim Jones exist. The plot to kill Jimmy Carter last week is the same way these assassination teams work. Last week we did a tape and some information about the assassination plot to kill Carter. That was the May 11th tape, number 388. And then that evening, the San Francisco Examiner came out. Evidence now indicates a four-man plot to kill Carter, and it became more open in the news that there was a four-man plot. And a long article about the evidence of a gun case and ammunition and corroborative testimony and credibility to the story that there was a plot to kill Carter. And more news came out this week about two Mexicans who stayed at the hotel who had rifles, that three of them stayed in a room. One was named Humberto Camacho. They checked out the same day of Carter's visit. And as I say, when the diversionary was arrested, Mr. Raymond Lee Harvey, they had split, but the ammunition and so forth was back in this hotel room. Now, the Pentagon, the CIA, the Defense Department that wants to kill Jimmy Carter and get ready for this little war that they want in Russia or Middle East, can't allow a four-man plot. That's a no-no. So what do? By the time the week is over, the story has cooled down. A newspaper article, May the 15th, said Carter plot suspect is mentally ailing. And they went on to say that he was a 36-year-old Skid Row resident, that he suffered mental disabilities, that his problems started when he was molested by an uncle at the age of 4. They left out the Twinkies and the six-pack Coke that motivated Dan White to do his double murders. But the article goes on to say he was in and out of institutions, and he was in Cincinnati at a home for a long time, a lot of his childhood. Maybe he shared a room with Charles Manson or knew Sarah Jane Moore. I wonder what the Cincinnati connections are, that he spent his juvenile years confined like Charles Manson. But then they went on to say that he was hospitalized in Texas, where John Kennedy was killed, and California, where Sirhan was programmed. His hospitalizations, interestingly enough, were in Texas and California, and the two assassination attempts on Jimmy Carter in the last month and a half were Texas and California. And then the conclusion of the article this week is he has multiple diagnoses which change depending on what psychiatrist makes the diagnosis. If that weren't so sad, you could laugh. That's as bad as giving this guy an alias of Raymond Lee Harvey and working with Oswaldo Espinoza. He has multiple diagnoses which changes depending on what psychiatrist makes a diagnosis. So as of this week, my news from Washington, Washington Post, New York Times, the papers are completely wiped out. The plot is forgotten. The two Mexicans that got away are forgotten. And there were schools to train assassins there. His cohort is forgotten. And now all the guilt goes on the guy that was picked up by the Secret Service, the man who had the starter pistol, and he just happened to be in the plaza where Carter was speaking because he was molested when he was 4 years old by an uncle, and he's a member of the Skid Row community. And the responsibility goes on to this loner with all these problems and these mental diseases in and out of hospitals. Forget the other three cases solved. Nothing happened. This was just a man with a bad case history. So forget the plot, and that's the way the stories get buried and buried. And if any single one of them were solved along the way, we wouldn't end up with these other assassinations. But this is the kind of sloppy newspaper collusion conspiracy to let the other two get away. His cohort is silenced up, and all the blame is put onto somebody because he had an uncle who molested him when he was 4 years old, which has nothing at all to do with test firing at MacArthur Park, at test firing the starter pistol of the shells, the ammunition, the placement of these people, the going into the rooms of the woman that worked for the Los Angeles Times, the woman they were looking for on the balcony, the other searches. All of this background has nothing to do with the placement of the people, the weapon capability, the way they got away, the use of aliases, coming in from Mexico and disappearing again. And one day, Carter will get it, and they'll be right on his track. It could be the same people, but you'll never know, because the other people have aliases and are not identified. Mayor George Moscone's name comes up many times with regards to the People's Temple. Jim Jones was instrumental in getting a lot of people bussed into San Francisco to make sure that Moscone became the mayor of that city. But Jim Jones and Tim Stone and D.A. Freitas and the temple contacts were very much a part of the politics of San Francisco. December the 2nd, 1978, there was an article in the San Francisco Chronicle or the Examiner, I forget which one it is now, Temple Gun Running Probe Denied. And this is a press release done by the aide of the late Mayor George Moscone, strongly denying an NBC News report that the San Francisco Police Department started and then stopped without any explanation after George Moscone was dead. And, of course, he just died a week after the Jonestown massacre. They were investigating the links of gun running of Jonestown and the possibility that they were making large shipments of cash and explosive and guns to South America by way of Canada. Now, this was brought up and then hushed, and of course we know public denials from somebody dead are hard enough to follow. The denials of Richard Nixon and John Mitchell and John Ehrlichman and Robert Haldeman all prove that they lie under oath. I don't have to keep reminding you of Watergate. But the aide to George Moscone was outraged at the fact that there were these allegations of this gun running. I don't know why he should be outraged. It seems to me that unless there was something to hide between George Moscone and Jim Jones, he would ask for a full-scale investigation of it. Why would he, according to the Associated Press, strongly deny that San Francisco police first started and then stopped without any explanation an investigation of alleged gun running by People's Temple? That's Mel Wax, who's now working for Dianne Feinstein, the new mayor. He said it's an absolutely outrageous lie. Why didn't he tell NBC, if they had reason for the gun running, to go to the San Francisco Police Department and Charles Gaines, because they trained several of the gunmen, the killers, down in Jonestown, and also weapons came from the San Francisco Police Department. The same thing was true of the SLA. They trained some members of the SLA, and some of the weapons were associated with the San Francisco Police Department. I don't know why the aide to the late George Moscone would be outraged at the People's Temple was arranging large shipments of cash and explosive and guns to South America. Just say, I don't know anything about it, and Moscone is dead, but look it up. Why does he have to defend George Moscone unless Moscone was wiped out and the investigation of the gun running was then stopped because Moscone was dead? Another article about George Moscone, which was not resolved at the time of his murder, this came 2 months before Jonestown. And it's an interesting one. It says, rumors of a Moscone probe, and this is from the San Francisco Chronicle, October the 8th, 1978. And the rumor was that George Moscone, the all-out high school basketball team member, a great all-American boy, they referred to him as the all-American boy like Dan White, moved quickly from a supervisor to a state senator. Mr. Kling, virtually spotless, was now being investigated, and they were sniffing around because the federal bloodhounds, according to this article, were finding memos that linked him to the Howard Hughes organization that allegedly Moscone could do favors at the airport for locating the offices abuse Air West. Now, there's a article here on $10,000 made to Joe Cerell, C-E-R-R-E-L-L, once a Moscone campaign manager, and the $10,000 certainly wasn't exposed much of the time George Moscone was dead. The investigation of the Hughes connections, and there are other articles I have of the Hughes connections to George Moscone and the San Francisco politics, and that's important because the Manson case, Charles Manson's property at Spahn Ranch, was actually part of the Hughes empire. It was the Hughes set for the outlaw, and he was friendly with Spahn. But the San Francisco violences have close connections to the Central Intelligence Agency and the FBI, and I've maintained for a long time that the Hughes organization is the umbrella for the murders and the assassinations, and it is the counterintelligence operation that used Robert Mayhew, for example, to hire organized crime for specific assassination teams like Sam Giancana and John Roselli. But out on the West Coast, there was an article just 2 months before Moscone died of a probe that was to take place. Now, what if Moscone had to be killed because of this money being transferred, say, to guns or drugs or San Francisco connections to Jim Jones down in Jonestown? Maybe he had to be murdered 2 months later, because when the Jonestown story broke, a lot of the source of funding, which could go to the Bahama banks, the Panama banks, and so forth, could come from the Hughes organizations, which is identical to saying the Defense Department and the CIA money passing through Moscone. Just 2 months before his murder in the city hall, these memos were being investigated and discussed. The same district attorney, Joseph Freitas, who was a buddy and roommate and close friend of Tim Stone from the People's Temple, wasn't investigating these allegations because he said the U.S. attorney in Sacramento would look into them, and he didn't want to, in quotes, jeopardize their investigations. But what if Freitas and all these people had a can of worms here with Hughes money being siphoned through the San Francisco political machine down to Jim Jones, that included the sources of the money for weapons and drugs and so forth? And 2 months later, as soon as Jones is dead, the number one target to wipe out is George Moscone. A gentleman by the name of Harry Crook from Sterling Heights, Michigan, has been studying hypnosis for many, many years. And there was an article in San Jose Mercury just a week ago Sunday. It says, hypnotist suspects Sirhan was in a trance. Now, just suppose that Sirhan is Dan White in this case. He says he trained a subject to carry out suggestions to the letter, that she fired a gun, which was unloaded, and pointed it as if it would have killed somebody, and then fell in a deep sleep. This man has been studying hypnosis for 25 years. He's convinced, on the basis of his own work and Cold War experiments by the CIA, he says, that Sirhan was hypnotized. He wrote to the CIA, he wrote to the FBI, the Secret Service. He got no replies. They referred to him as being a kook. And he said that in 1970, he hypnotized a man and persuaded him to murder his own father, a minister, and he had eight other people watching them. This was in 1970 as witnesses. The murder didn't take place, but it would have been performed because he shot his father, but they were blanks, and he didn't kill the man, but he was willing to do it and had been hypnotized to do it. And he goes into other CIA experiments where secretaries and volunteer persons, according to the tests, the MKUltra programs released now, can be programmed to kill. He said he took one person, a subject, who carried out everything he told her exactly. She was given an unloaded gun. He made her angry. He hypnotized her and made her angry at the party. Another female colleague, he told her that, in quotes, her rage would be so great that she wouldn't hesitate to kill. And he took this subject and she carried out every suggestion. She fired the gun at this person and then fell asleep. And when she woke up, she was absolutely denying she ever fired a gun. She had a deep sleep. And he said there is formidable evidence that premeditated and political murders can be the kind that are programmed. And certainly the Dan White situation was premeditated. He got a phone call, went downstairs, put the bullets in his pocket, asked somebody to take him to the city hall, blowing on his hands all the time, not looking at the party or acting in a normal way of conversation, but blowing on his hands as if they're going to get hot, going through a window, He could have gone through the detector and left guns. If he had a rage at the door to protect himself and the others from this rage, he went through a bathroom window conveniently opened and then shot point blank at these people. And the persons that this man programmed in Michigan couldn't remember what happened, and neither could Sirhan remember, and he says he doesn't remember his diary, and so forth. Mr. Crook says he's tried to work with a defense psychologist, Dr. Martin Shore, and work on this story and work with Sirhan to deprogram him. But that's the last thing that the prison system or the defense attorney of Sirhan wants. But this man has done it twice or more times with people and had them be willing to kill a friend or a father and then shoot and go into sleep and not remember and not know whether or not there were blanks in there or not, whether they had killed him, and then not remember the incident at all. Dan White could remember that Mayor George Moscone had told him he could be back on the Board of Supervisors after he resigned, but he may not remember the killing and the instances that programmed him, that instructed him to go down and do the shooting. Another comparison between Dan White and Jack Ruby, as well as the Sirhan case, is the programming and certain words that trigger these men off. The San Francisco Chronicle had an article I mentioned last week about a poster advertising a book on Ireland that Dan White had and held close to his heart, and it had two words. One was mystic and the other was martyr. And as soon as he was arrested, Dan White felt like he was a martyr. He had said, I gave you the quotation, that they were out to degrade me. They were going to hang me out to dry. He doesn't define who they are. When Jack Ruby was arrested after killing Lee Harvey Oswald, the first thing he said is, I wanted to show them a Jew had guts, and he didn't define who they were. And on the seat of Jack Ruby's car was a book on heroism and be a hero, and carrying along with Dan White were the posters of being a martyr. So each of them felt that they were being pleased or they were being used, and the same kind of reaction, the surprise that they'd done something wrong because they were being singled out as patsies. Martyr being the word for Dan White and heroism being the word for Jack Ruby. I noticed this last week, or rather 2 weeks ago, that a gentleman in the FBI has been promoted. He's been in the FBI for 28 years, and it was only a one-sentence remark. I think it was out of the San Francisco Chronicle, an Associated Press story. New FBI Laboratory Chief, Washington, Bill P. Herndon, 28-year veteran of the FBI, was named yesterday Assistant Director of the FBI Laboratory Division to replace Thomas Kelleher, who is retiring. That's the entire article. Bell P. Herndon's testimony before the Warren Commission is in Volume 14, pages 579 to 599, and he's the gentleman who administered that outrageous polygraph test to Jack Ruby. I wrote a play, which I should revise and get out. I think the time is ready for it now, called Tiger by the Tail. And the second act is the polygraph test given by Mr. Herndon to Jack Ruby, and the first act is the interview of Jack Ruby with Earl Warren, Gerald Ford, and Leon Jaworski. When I wrote that play about 10 years ago, these names weren't household words, but now that each one was promoted, one to investigate the Watergate and the Korea Gate and keep all the conspiratorial loose ends under the rug, Mr. Herndon has been now made the chief of the FBI Laboratory Division. Gerald Ford became president of the United States. Now those names are almost household words, and the play would have more meaning because the characters have been more clearly delineated by their political positions and the way they've moved to the top. Bell P. Herndon played a cat-and-mouse game with Jack Ruby, and at one point Jack Ruby was able to rewrite his controversial question that he was asked, the most important question of all, and it took about 20 minutes to rewrite it to his own suiting, and the same Mr. Herndon that's gotten this new promotion was the man who gave him the test. The question, number six of a series, was, did you first decide to shoot Oswald Sunday morning? And Jack Ruby answered yes, but then Mr. Herndon went on to testify, that's on page 591 of the hearings, that there was a slight impact in the test here when the question six was approach, which means to me, in interpreting the chart, that Ruby reached a peak of tension to question number six when it was asked, and he said, yes, did you first decide to shoot Oswald Sunday morning? And he said this particular peak on the question indicates that Ruby built up a physiological peak of tension to the time of Sunday morning with regard to his decision of shooting Lee Harvey Oswald. And, of course, it is my interpretation that the decision or the orders to kill a particular person on that weekend were made in Wednesday with Connie Trammell of the CIA and in the office of H.L. Hunt at the Mercantile Bank in Dallas, Texas. And Ruby had a hard time with that question, and the question answer didn't come out normally. But they don't challenge when did he first decide or know he was going to kill somebody, but they just said it was a physiological peak because of the tensions of the decision. Well, Mr. Herndon has been promoted. Dan White had all the markings of a trained zombie assassin. As I mentioned before last week on the tape, he went from poverty in a bare, sparse room to a $70,000 home. He had two trips to Ireland. He had mobility. He had drastic personality changes where he'd pull off and be alone. Did the question of the money, who bought the Porsche, the homes, and the furnishings, did it go through the city hall to a supervisor there? Was Hughes money in on this operation as the Hughes agents were on these other assassination teams? Where did Marianne White come from? She was in Germany teaching at an army base. She was in Japan teaching at an army base. And I met somebody this week who is associated with a woman who taught with her on the military base in the Philippines. The Philippines was a mind control center where Candy Jones had gone for the CIA to be tested and deliver messages. When was she at the Philippines? Was Dan White in the Philippines? Did he know her during the Vietnam stint and meet her later? These questions will never be asked probably by anybody but Mae Brussel, and certainly we need answers to how he met Marianne White and where he met her. He married her. He met her in April of 76. They were in San Francisco. They had a five-week honeymoon in Ireland, which is expensive for a San Francisco policeman. He had been to Ireland before, and shortly after they came home, he began to run for the Board of Supervisors and won that election spot. Where did he get the money for the lease of Pier 39, this expensive new property in San Francisco? Where did he get the money for the first trip to Ireland? Where did he get the money for the second? Where did he meet Marianne White? Could he have met her when he was in Vietnam, over in the Philippines? What was she doing at the Army bases? How long has she been associated with the United States Army? And is she still affiliated with them today? Why does Dan White avoid eye contact with her in court or in public? Why did he refer to that marriage in 76 as his duty? And what was she doing in Japan? Under what salary or what auspices was she in these three areas, Germany, Japan, and the Philippines? And was she with the Central Intelligence Agency or any training of a mind control program? Who is Marianne White? The entire defense of Dan White in San Francisco, as I stated last week, was that he was frustrated by the natural dirty politics in San Francisco. But none of the psychiatrists, the four psychiatrists who examined him, went into his past, who he was with, any more than they go into the past of Raymond Lee Harvey in Los Angeles or any other zombie assassins. Jack Ruby could shoot Lee Harvey Oswald because he's angry that John Kennedy was murdered. But they don't go into the CIA people they knew, the black money, the bag money, the associates, the people that could program them. Jack Ruby had Billy Del Mar in his nightclub, a hypnotist. He was close to David Ferry, a hypnotist. The act of the murder isn't the whole story. It's who they know before and how they're placed strategically in the hands of the police who cooperate. And that's one of the clues in all these cases. The police allow these two Mexican assassins to escape from Los Angeles, where Jimmy Carter was. The police allowed Dan White the luxury of walking in himself and not grabbing him and following him out of that building. By the time he made the first call, they could have picked up the car after two people were killed. At the Ambassador Hotel, they could have picked up Thane Caesar, who pulled a gun standing right behind Robert Kennedy, or the associates of Sirhan Sirhan that have been photographed that evening in the Ambassador Hotel. The police have all this information. but they let it happen, and the network of conspiracies is very, very tight. The CIA divulges that they have trained mind-controlled assassination projects. Jim Jones has a hit list, and the House of Representatives talks about assassination teams. A researcher in Michigan comes out this week with programming two people to, they're willing to murder their family and forget about it. And the mayor in San Francisco is killed. A member of the Board of Supervisors is killed. There's an assassination attempt on Jimmy Carter. And programmed assassins are out loose. And yet the average American person isn't allowed the luxury of adding it all together, plus the past historical experiences of where all these people were coming from and where their money was coming from. And we're not allowed the luxury to make the conclusions that Jonestown and the Carter assassination attempt and the murders in San Francisco of the mayor and the supervisor could possibly all be linked and covered by the same people and linked together. And that's what I believe is happening. And it's a tragedy because it will continue and the killings will continue. And that's why it's covered up, because they have more deaths to do in the future. We're out of time again, so I'll see you next week. You take care, okay? Mae Russell, Carmel, California.